In the coming week, Russia's destruction of Ukraine grinds on as global pressure on Russia grows. The second anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic declaration is marked, and Colombia's parliamentary elections mark the next test for the region. It's March 10th, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's begin by talking about Ukraine. Now, standard caveats apply. It's a fluid situation. Things could change in dramatic ways before the podcast goes live. But with that caveat aside, can you give us a sense of what we can anticipate in the coming days?
Sure, Jim. And as you say, it really changes day to day. And after we tape this, we could find certain things further advanced or further slowed down and some numbers going up higher and so forth. For example, let's just talk about the refugee numbers. At latest report now from the UN Refugee Agency, the numbers are at 2.3 million, of which something like 1.4 million or so are in Poland alone.
Well, at this time last week, Bob, it was just around a million.
So this is now being called, because of the rapidity of this and no signs of it slowing down, the fastest growing refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. So that surpasses the Balkan Wars of the 90s, where you had by volume the highest numbers since World War II. This is, you know, clearly on path to exceed that. So there's all the attendant concerns with that. But it also there's this fits and starts involving basic things like humanitarian corridors being opened up or violated. And I think one of the areas we're going to continue to look at, Jim, is there any traction for the most basic of agreements between Russia and Ukraine or Russia and any other parties that would seek to try to ameliorate the situation. And it's very dim news right now. The big news yesterday was the bombing of a children's hospital that had a maternity ward in it. And just absolutely awful reports and pictures emerging from that. Russia has denied doing that. It's called it a facility filled with nationalists or some such. And the ongoing disinformation pours out of Russia on all sorts of fronts. By most reporting, there seems to be a clear intent to ratchet up targeting of civilians, of medical facilities, and generally an attempt to really intimidate and instill fear in Ukrainians to bring them to heal much quicker than they have been. And they are not by any reporting that we've seen throughout the country.
On that score, Bob, are we getting any sense that the Russian military campaign is making significant advances?
Certainly not significant, Jim. They seem to be making advances in the southern part of the region. So the region where this maternity hospital is bombed is Mariupol, crucial center that is just north of the Crimean region that's controlled by Russia. And they would love to consolidate. The Russian forces would love to consolidate that whole region and move westward into Odessa and really sort of take over the southern swath of the country and really control completely its Black Sea ports and so on. Some of that is happening, but a lot slower than by most accounts Russia had wanted it to. But that's those are campaigns to watch very closely.
It seems to be coming at a high price as well, Bob. I've seen estimates that the Russians may have lost as many as 6,000 soldiers killed in the first 2 weeks of fighting. That would put it just behind the number of troops the United States lost in Afghanistan and Iraq over 20 years.
That's right, Jim. And these are reports initially, there are all sorts of reports coming from primarily Ukrainian sources, but there are a number of now efforts to corroborate sourcing, and you're getting it from U.S. intelligence officials, which are very cautious in their estimates, but also various open source reporting as well, Jim. And it's whether it's the numbers that you mentioned or it's like heavy armaments, tanks, the Russians seem to be experiencing extremely heavy losses and without any really great change in tactics other than ratcheting up the missile attacks on soft civilian targets and as well as things like prime infrastructure, airports, and so on. It's I'm trying to think back and to see any sort of parallels in terms of Russian behavior. One thing that comes up for me, Jim, is recalling the different Chechen campaigns. This is when in the 90s when you had the separatist Chechen Republic. Initially, it was a campaign led by a renegade former Soviet Air Force officer, Joker Dudayev. That people don't recall, that campaign ended basically in a stalemate. The Russian forces were defeated. They were humiliated. And they just sort of froze things. When Vladimir Putin took power, he revived the Chechen campaign and went, as many have noted now, sort of medieval and also just leveled the capital of Chechnya, Grozny, and made common cause with a local warlord and basically brought it to heel. Many worry that that's what he has in mind for Ukraine, or it's certainly Ukraine's urban centers that have been pushing back the strongest. Russia has the firepower to do things like that. that. In terms of being able to come in and decapitate the government and hold parts of Ukraine, that's looking very doubtful, Jim. Even in places like Kherson, this important city that fell in the south of Ukraine, you're seeing footage emerge from there of citizens openly protesting, holding mini parades and so forth with Ukrainian flags and protesting against Russian occupiers. So it's just raising questions about how this longer campaign is going to play out, Jim.
Well, certainly it does raise the question, Bob, if the Russians do succeed in taking a significant part of Ukraine, how in the world are they going to hold it? You don't necessarily even need an insurgency. Just having a public that refuses to comply can cause chaos. So I think it's going to be something to watch. Do you get a sense that there may be some cracks appearing in the Kremlin's approach to Ukraine? I've seen a spate of news stories in the last day or so talking about how perhaps Putin's way of talking about the crisis has changed, so that signals potentially an imminent diplomatic opening.
It's a very good question, and people are desperate. I think some of the people who are trying to glean this are a little bit desperate for it to happen on one hand. And it's hard to say whether it is, Jim. We've just had one of the bigger diplomatic attempts that took place where you had the foreign ministers of Russia and Ukraine, Sergei Lavrov and Dmytro Kuleba, meeting in Turkey. This had not happened yet. Remember, Russia barely considers Ukraine as a legitimate state and has dismissed it as less than that. And yet you did have the state level meeting of the top members of the foreign ministry talking. However, they're talking past each other. As Kuleba said after the talks, quote, Russia is not in a position at this point to establish a ceasefire. They seek a surrender from Ukraine. That is not what they're going to get, end quote from Kuleba. Lavrov himself had come out at a press statement where he was sort of visibly kind of fidgeting and so forth. It's been much commented on, but basically saying Russia has not invaded Ukraine and making statements that are on their face of it just patently false. So it seemed like a very odd opening if we're supposed to look at that as a diplomatic opening, Jim. But it did happen. The fact that it happened is very interesting. One wonders also what is the connection between any of these sort of discussions going on, ceasefire talks at other levels, and the Kremlin. You've had any number of ceasefire talks now that are supposed to have established some sort of a pause so that civilians can leave, and then they are quickly violated. And it's...
Well, Putin has a pretty good track record of saying one thing and doing another, so he's not someone that you would necessarily take at his word.
Yes, and so that raises the question, are these by design? Are these by fumbled coordination? It's hard to say. The proof is in the pudding at the end of the day, and at this point, it's hard to establish anything but, you know, like a trustworthy position from Russia. We had a number of high-level contacts, mostly by phone over the weekend, including Emmanuel Macron, who's been maybe the most regular interlocutor of Putin, and he says he sees no sign of him budging at all from his maximalist position on Ukraine. So that's where we're at, Jim. It's very dispiriting. Meanwhile, you're seeing all sorts of other signs of, if not cracks, then vulnerabilities on the Russian side. The latest reporting is that Russians, perhaps by the tens of thousands, are fleeing the country, especially those from the tech sphere. Russia has had a very established, very respected tech sector. And you have people fleeing to Finland. You have people fleeing to Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, now independent country, and trying to get to places where there are still flights, like Serbia and things like that. That's going to be worth watching as well, while there's an attempt by the Kremlin to have a sort of a total blockade on information, taking over media. Instead of Echo Moscow, which used to be the last independent radio station, you have Radio Sputnik on those airwaves. And so, you know, we'll see how this plays out on the domestic front, which is something we've talked about before. Putin does have a pretty iron grip on the country, but it's not clear whether or not it's sustainable given the penalties that I think he and many others did not expect to be this severe at this point.
But certainly for Putin in the short term, having people who are most critical of what he is doing leave the country eases domestic political pressure. It may create very significant long-term economic problems if you lose, you know, critical workers and the like, but in the near term, it can actually be a sort of a release valve of pressure. But I'm curious, Bob, given that it doesn't look like Putin is going to back down anytime soon, where do you see moves to intensify economic pressure on Putin going?
So you've seen the big moves this past week of the U.S. and the U.K. cutting off Russian energy supplies. U.S. and U.K. not being heavily reliant on them. They're not insignificant amounts.
It's less than 3% of U.S. oil imports.
Exactly. But still in all, it translates into at least shorter term increases in prices at the pump. We've all been watching as they've been ratcheting up in the U.S., getting close to historic levels if you adjust for inflation. And the big question is whether the European sources, some of which are completely dependent on Russian energy, are able to find any sort of diversification and alternatives in the shorter term that can allow them to either, one, proactively move away, decouple, or be able to sustain a cutoff from Russia, which Russia has threatened, Jim. So those are important steps. You have almost every day announcements by private sector firms from the West that they're leaving Russia, major law firms. firms. So Goldman Sachs today is pulling out a major bank. You have McDonald's closing more than 800 franchises in Russia. McDonald's is one of those first sort of major, it was a very iconic moment when McDonald's opened up in Pushkin Square in Moscow, for example, Jim. These are things that are, you know, that are all kind of reverberating, I think, and showing this country getting more and more isolated. You add that to the media, the sense of media isolation, it creates an appearance. It also can create a sense of embattlement and perhaps further defensiveness and further digging in, Jim. But it is happening. As you see attacks like the one in Mariupol, and unfortunately probably further ones, it is creating this high level of disgust and concern about what Russia has become and what it means to do business with Russia.
What about military pressure, Bob? This week we had a big flap over whether or not the United States would support Poland sending MiG-29s to Ukraine. The United States government at the end came out and said no, it did not support it, arguing that this would be an escalatory step that the United States was unwilling to take. Where do you see sort of the military pressure aspect of this going?
Yeah, I think we're all learning a bit more about kind of nuclear statecraft or the ways in which nuclear red lines are established. And messaging is absolutely important. And I think whether it comes to no-fly zones, which has been, I think, pretty definitively seen from NATO countries as a no-go because it could bring into contact with Russian forces, NATO forces.
Well, the way you impose a no-fly zone is you shoot down planes on the other side.
Exactly.
And to protect your planes, you generally proactively take out radar sites and the like. And so you can see the easy recipe for a road to escalation.
Right. And then you had the U.S. Defense Department coming down very firmly saying it would not authorize a transfer of MiGs to Ukraine, also seeing that as an escalatory step, a step that it deemed as a step too far in this. And it's walking a line, Jim. And again, it's, as I said, kind of learning what the lines are and what the red lines are, because at the same time, there are all sorts of other weapons that are being expedited and facilitated for Ukraine that will damage and hurt and kill Russians and damage Russian forces and stop their advance, which Russia could deem to be a step too far if it saw fit. Putin has threatened as such, as have other Russian officials. But it is, in the greater scheme of things, perhaps a step short of that absolutely crucial red line that might trigger some sort of a nuclear response. Speaking of nuclear response, I think the other thing that's worth mentioning is concern about what Russia might be willing to allow to happen in Chernobyl. Chernobyl plant, infamous for the most serious nuclear accident in history, continues to be a plant where energy was supplied to maintain cooling of heating rods and is not a source of energy for Ukraine, but it is a receiver of energy to allow it to cool off these rods to prevent any sort of escalatory action and potentially an explosion, radioactivity, and so forth that could damage not only Ukraine or Belarus, but Russia as well as parts of Western Europe. There are all sorts of scenarios that are quite disturbing if the Chernobyl situation gets out of hand. Russia controls that militarily. There are Ukrainian staff reportedly working there around the clock trying to keep things running and stable, but it seems like an untenable situation, Jim. The IAEA has been monitoring it, but this is another one of those cases where is Russia just like closing off this? There were reports that there was going to be a meeting involving IAEA, Russian and Ukrainian officials to kind of get this sorted out. But, you know, we don't know whether Russia gets so antagonized that it decides it's going to explore its options and maybe use this as leverage.
Well, it's a good point, Bob. And we've been talking to this point or juncture of the podcast about some of the short-term decisions and consequences of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But there are also potentially big ripple effects that could be very long lasting. Just one that I will flag is that Ukraine is known as the breadbasket of Europe. It has 25% of the world's black dirt, which is really good for growing things. It is the world's fourth largest exporter of wheat, I think also of corn, things like barley, sunflower seeds, sunflower being the national flower of Ukraine, is a big part of vegetable oils around the world. And this crop is going to come off the world market, and it's going to intensify grain shortages we're already seeing around the world. Again, think of it this way. If you're a farmer in Ukraine, are you going to be able to plant, get the seeds to plant? Will you get fuel to be able to power your farm implements? Even if you can grow things, can you harvest it? Can you get it to the port? Can the port take grain away? And so you can imagine countries that are big grain importers. Think Egypt, for example, could be in big trouble, or China. China is a big food importer, gets a lot of wheat and corn from from Ukraine? What are the consequences if these grains go off the market, not available? We're already seeing commodity prices go up. So this is one way in which we can just see a tremendous amount of pain being felt worldwide. I will also note, and I think we mentioned this in one of our prior podcasts, that Ukraine is not the only humanitarian disaster happening in the world today. You can think of Myanmar, Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, and resources to address those humanitarian concerns are already in short supply. So I think this is going to be something very considerable. I'll just leave you with one stat I came across this week. Right now, 1 in 29 people around the world need humanitarian assistance. 1 in 29.
Yeah, it's staggering. And if you did the math on that and extrapolated it, it's a staggering amount, Jim. And there are the perennials that we've talked about, but also new places. And we're about to talk about COVID-19, which is not gone as well. And that's layered upon that as well. So it is one thing after another. The only other thing I would add on the grain front is that I've seen noted that when you combine Russia and Ukraine, it's like almost one third of the world's wheat and barley come from those two countries. One is under heavy sanction, the other one is being destroyed, and it's sending untold ripple effects around the world, Jim.
Exactly right, Bob.
Well, Jim, I mentioned the COVID pandemic. We are just approaching the second anniversary of the WHO's declaration of the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. Center for Disease Control reports that upwards of 1 million Americans have died from COVID-19. Globally, that figure has surpassed something like 6 million. Both are supposed to be, by the way, much higher than those official numbers. So, Jim, can you give us a sense of where we stand both here in the U.S. and abroad in the global effort to get vaccines into arms and get the virus under control?
Well, Bob, the reality is that we are far behind where we need to be. As you note, the death toll in the United States is just short of 1 million. At current rates, we should exceed that mark by May. Worldwide, it's over 6 million. And as you noted, both numbers are likely an undercount. Vaccines are clearly critical in being able to reduce not just the death toll, but the problems of morbidity and severe illness. Again, vaccines do not reduce the chance of infection to zero, but it's pretty clear that at least some of the vaccines reduce the likelihood of severe illness and death. The problem is we're not getting enough shots in arms. Now, when you start talking about vaccination, it gets pretty complicated very quickly because we have so many different vaccines on the market. They differ in their effectiveness with different variants of COVID. They have different periods in which they're effective. And then there's the question of what kind of immunity is generated by contracting COVID and how long does that last? So there's a lot of complexity here.
And the role of boosters, I would say, too.
And the role of boosters. So in the United States, 3 in 4 Americans have had at least one shot. 2 in 3 are fully vaccinated as defined by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, meaning that they have either gotten one shot of the Johnson & Johnson or 2 of the Pfizer or Moderna. But of those people who are defined as fully vaccinated, less than 1 out of 2 have had a booster shot. Now, again, in the United States, the problem isn't a shortage of vaccines. It's vaccine hesitancy, or really, that's just a euphemism for refusing to get a vaccine. In much of the rest of the world, the problem is not having access to vaccines at all. Now, the estimates are that some 5 billion people have received a dose of one vaccine. That's about 65% of the global population. By some estimates, 58% of the world's population is fully vaccinated. But this could be a meaningless statistic because many people who have been vaccinated with vaccines that have questionable effectiveness against the COVID virus or against certain variants like Omicron. Here I'm thinking of the Chinese and Russian vaccines. There's also great variation in vaccines across countries. The United Arab Emirates leads the world in vaccination with having 98% of its population fully vaccinated. On the other end of the spectrum, you have Burundi. About 0.1% of the population of Burundi has been vaccinated, and you can see why the numbers are so low. They're averaging about 52 doses a day. And indeed, when you look at low-income countries as a whole, probably less than 10% of people living in low-income countries have been vaccinated. That compares to about 80% on average in high-income countries. And again, the reason all this matters is the potential for another variant to emerge that is highly transmissible and is able to evade existing vaccines. And even if we avoid that outcome, the reality is the existing variants are lethal to people, particularly people who have comorbidities, and particularly people living in countries that don't have strong, robust public healthcare systems.
You know, Jim, a lot of what you just mentioned is certainly well known to the leading health experts in the world and to leading officials in the richest countries in the world and the most prosperous countries. And in the Biden administration, which set out a priority and had sort of special symmetry around this issue, and they were going to get these vaccines out in record numbers and so forth. So what do you see as stalling it? Is it all these other epic things that have dominated our podcast discussions, as well as taking up any sort of momentum that was underway? Or is it other sort of lagging? Is it the fatigue of the whole issue, perhaps slowing things down?
Well, like many of the issues we discuss on The World Next Week, Bob, this is a complex issue that has lots of factors. Run through some of the issues you have to deal with in terms of getting shots in arms. One is you have to have vaccine. Some countries have a lot. Those countries that produce it made sure they held vaccines for their own people. If you aren't a producer of vaccines, and that's the case of most countries, you have to rely on your ability to get it either through the open market, where at least initially vaccines were in short supply, or through various multilateral organizations and efforts, COVAX being the most well-known one. Now, COVAX has shipped about 1.2 billion doses to some 140 or so countries, but its original goal was to get to 2 billion by the end of 2022. And again, when you step back and think about it, trying to get shots in arms of people all over the world is a big logistical lift. I mean, this is not something that is easy. It is further complicated by the fact that some of the vaccines, think Moderna, think the Pfizer shot, require special handling, a certain level of refrigeration that may not be available. Then you have to have a public health system that is well organized and able to get shots into people and to track them to make sure people come back to get shots later on. And then, of course, you have the whole issue of vaccine hesitancy or the refusal to take the vaccine. And again, that has been fueled by a tremendous amount of misinformation out on the internet. Again, the internet is a great purveyor of information and facts. It is also perhaps the greatest purveyor of misinformation.
Yeah, as has been called by WHO and other sources, the infodemic is in some ways just as threatening as the pandemic.
No, it certainly is. And again, countries that have really cracked down, think China, are struggling right now to keep the COVID infection rates down. We're seeing a real surge in Hong Kong. After 2 years of averaging just a couple of cases today, Hong Kong is now seeing new cases on the order of 50 to 55,000 a day. And it now has the world's highest death rate. And again, the question is, can China keep the infection from spreading from Hong Kong to the mainland? And as best we can tell, the vaccines that the Chinese have developed, Sinovac and Sinopharm, aren't especially effective against the Omicron variant of COVID. So the question is, what happens there? What could the consequences be? Because if China sticks to its zero tolerance policy, you could see the Chinese shutting down their economy. And then again, this is connected to the rest of the world economy. And it could be just another jolt to what has been a very choppy couple of years in terms of international economics and supply chain disruptions.
Well, then let's hope by year three of this grim anniversary, Jim, there's a lot more progress to cite.
We are certainly hoping that'll be the case, Bob. Let's switch gears and talk about politics. Let's talk about a congressional election, but not one in the United States, Bob, but one that is coming up this Sunday in Colombia. Colombians are going to be heading to the polls to choose a new Congress. The Colombian Congress currently has six conservative parties that are aligned with the current president, Iván Duque. These right-leaning parties hold approximately two-thirds of the seats in the Colombian Senate and a similar portion in the Colombian House. But Colombia's elections are taking place against a backdrop of, let's call it a left-wing, leftist drift across Central and South America. We're seeing a number of other countries in the region, the election of younger, more progressive politicians championing leftist policies. Are we going to see a repeat of that in Colombia, Bob?
Well, Jim, there certainly could be the ingredients for that, because while it's obviously has its own distinct issues, Colombia, a country of 50 million people, came out of a brutal civil war period about 5 or 6 years ago, although there's some vestiges of that that could be resurging in the countryside. That's something to keep an eye on. But it's got big problems of economic inequality. It has had bouts of police violence. violence, as well as that, what I mentioned, resurgent violence in rural areas from armed groups. It's got political corruption issues, scandals, all of which had created a number of demonstrations last year. And now we're seeing a number of activists from those protests in 2021 running for office amid this frustration against the political establishment. These are echoes of what we heard in Chile, for example, where you had the recent election of Gabriel Boric, a leftist student activist. Peru's had, you've had leftist candidates succeeding. You had a reform candidate winning in Honduras recently. It's not a complete wash across the region of a huge surging tide. However, it is something to watch. And there are polls showing that the Democratic Center Party of President Duque could be facing a defeat, while the progressive parties, the more progressive parties like Historic Pact, which is a coalition of the progressive opposition Senator Gustavo Petro, could become the biggest political force in the Senate, for example, or the Green Alliance could pick up seats. This is also going to be important not only for what it says for the composition of Congress and the legislative action in Colombia, but as it's sort of teeing things up for late May presidential elections. Duque is constitutionally prevented from running again, and there's a question of whether or not emerging figures like Petro could be strong enough to sort of lay the groundwork for a victorious presidential campaign. I should also mention Colombia's president is actually, as we're taping this podcast, visiting President Joe Biden in Washington today, sort of reinforcing the importance of that alliance, really important hemispheric alliance between the United States and Colombia, where just the sheer number of issues they're going to discuss shows that, whether it's migration, Colombia is a host to something like 1.7 million Venezuelans, Jim, but also reinforcing Colombia's opposition to the invasion of Ukraine, or setting in motion some of the topics that are going to come up at the June Summit of the Americas, which is going to deal with migration, but also maybe a new approach to counter narcotics. So a whole host of things are on the table and are at stake in these elections. And it's going to be yet another really important sort of trend to watch in northern parts of South America.
Bob, let me ask you a quick question playing off of the week's events. Given that Colombia's next door neighbor is Venezuela, we had a delegation of the United States government show up in Caracas, as you know, bad feeling between the two countries for quite some time, seen a big exodus of Venezuelans into Colombia under the inept dictatorial rule of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Do you see anything happening in the Colombian elections that might feed into this dialogue between the United States and Venezuela?
Well, it is hard to talk about Colombia without mentioning Venezuela, and for all sorts of reasons. The reason I mentioned was the migration in one direction, but there's also a lot of Colombians who actually live in Venezuela who are eligible to vote, who are going to be voting in border communities as well. The fate of both countries continues to be intertwined, Jim. So that will be very interesting to watch, whether there's some sort of U.S. softening towards Venezuela and maybe engagement because of the rapidly changing geopolitical situation and geoeconomic, for that matter, could set in motion things that we haven't foreseen. It certainly, I think, surprised a lot of people when you had a U.S. delegation visiting Venezuela last weekend, I believe. There were some immediate reports that were a couple of Americans were released from detention that had been held by Venezuelans. There are any number of fronts, but I think a main one is Venezuela, for all of its problems and its mismanagement and its corruption, has one of the major proven, if not the largest proven resources of oil in the world. And Russia has made inroads there in terms of assisting its production such as it is at the moment and having no problem in supporting Maduro. But if there's a wedge there, it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops as, again, the world kind of goes through major upheaval in response to the Ukraine invasion.
Tying this back to our opening conversation, Bob, looking at Venezuela, it's a good reminder that while we like to talk about how the world has been outraged by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that's not exactly true. There are still a large number of countries that are either supporting Russia or sitting on the sidelines. Two of the most obvious, China, which has continued to back Russia. The Indians have been trying to play neutral, but you can also find countries like Brazil seeming to say quite nice things about Vladimir Putin. So I think we have to avoid the notion that there's this unified world or international community that has decided to press Russia. There are an awful lot of countries who either see it as none of their business or see it as just a dispute among wealthy countries.
Really good point, Jim. I would add to the Brazil, Argentina has also made no qualms about seeking to maintain warm relations with Russia, despite all the recent developments. So yes, very important. And it's been pointed out also that while Russia does not have strong interests in the Western Hemisphere, certainly hasn't expanded sort of methodically as China has in some of its relationships, it would be very interested in playing a disruptive role vis-a-vis the United States in its own backyard.
Yeah, well, I think that's been Putin's strategy for the last 15 years.
Jim, we've talked our way segue into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. This is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Amazon morphs to Savannah. I fear I know what that is, Jim, but can you tell me the significance?
Bob, I assume that our listeners are referring to a study that was published this week in the peer-reviewed academic journal Nature Climate Change. Scientists reviewed decades of satellite data of so-called pristine parts of the Amazon rainforest. And what they found in a nutshell is that the Amazon is sick. It's losing its ability to bounce back from environmental stresses like drought and fire. And they're greatly concerned that we are going to see in the coming decades a dieback of the Amazon rainforest and it turning into savanna or grasslands. Now, this is significant because the Amazon obviously is one of the wettest places on Earth, but it has experienced three significant droughts over the last two decades. And people may think, well, okay, you have a jungle, it goes to a savanna. What's significant about that? There are at least four dangers. One is that the Amazon, in some sense, functions like lungs for the planet. It sucks carbon out of the air. If the Amazon rainforest disappears, it won't be serving that function. But there's a flip side to it, point number two, and that is as plant matter decays, it will release all of that carbon into the atmosphere, which is going to accelerate climate change. Third problem is that if we see the disappearance of the rainforest, you're going to have a tremendous loss of biodiversity with unknown consequences. And number four, if the Amazon rainforest disappears or shrinks tremendously, it is going to change weather. It is going to change weather not just in Latin America, but across the globe. That is because a lot of rain is generated over the Amazon rainforest. If that turns into grassland, the basic mechanisms are disrupted and they're going to have ripple effects. So in all, this is another study in a long line of studies that have come out over the last couple decades now saying that humanity is flirting with disaster. Now, I'd like to think that this is the study that is going to make governments around the world sit up and take notice and take the steps needed to reduce the emission of heat-trapping gases, to find ways to store more carbon, and to think seriously about adaptation. I think the reality is this story is going to be one or two days and forgotten amidst all the other news, and we do so at our peril.
Oh, and like so much else on the climate front, it's a governance matter as well. I mean, we have seen previous Brazilian governments, including the government of Lula, take steps to try to create a more sustainable approach to managing the Amazon, meanwhile, drawing some of the value out of it while not plundering it. We saw current President Bolsonaro go in and really vigorously step up the raising of the Amazonian forest cover. He's paid lip service, including at the UN General Assembly just last fall, he's paid lip service to the stewardship of the Amazon, but people don't see it as much beyond that.
Well, we had the big Amazon fires in which led a number of world leaders, including the French president, to suggest that something needed to be done. And President Bolsonaro told them basically to back off. This is Brazilian territory. Brazil is sovereign. Don't bother us.
And so we will see, speaking of elections, as we have repeatedly in the region, there's Brazilian elections this fall with all sorts of important issues at stake. This is one of them. So we'll see whether that plays a role. Bolsonaro has been seen as trailing in the polls and has been very concerned about that. So it's going to be one to watch again, Jim.
It is a national election that can have international consequences.
Well, that's our look at the troubled world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. An early presidential election is held in authoritarian Turkmenistan. The Ghana Oil, Gas, and Energy Summit takes place, and Indians hold the annual Festival of Colors.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be healthy out there, please.